You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, a new study finds evidence that some U.S. teens are trading sex for food. We'll look at the changing face of hunger in America.
First, you may remember reports from earlier this summer about the price of EpiPens going up over 400%. The portable device that can halt potentially lethal allergic reactions has long been the go-to prescription medication that people can carry in their purses or their pockets in case they get a severe allergic reaction.
After widespread uproar among doctors, patients, and parents of kids with allergies, U.S. senators have been keeping a close eye on price hikes of essential prescriptions. Wisconsin's Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin recently co-sponsored a bipartisan bill that aims to address the issue.
The bill wouldn't prevent drug makers from raising prices, but if they do decide to raise the cost of a prescription by more than 10%, they would have to file a transparency and justification report for the Department of Health and Human Services.
Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin joins us now. Senator Baldwin, welcome to Central Time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
So talk with us about the impetus for this bill. Why work on this issue right now?
Well, drug corporations are really sticking it to the American taxpayers and consumers with soaring drug prices. We've seen several widely publicized instances. So the public knows well about, for example, the EpiPen that went from $100 to $600. And these are life-saving drugs and devices that people rely on to extend their lives, to save their lives. And there's no explanation on why there would be such a massive, drastic price increase. But we're finding, aside from the well-publicized instances, that hundreds of brand-name medications in the United States are the prices are being increased. And I've been hearing from literally countless Wisconsinites about how frightening this is, how difficult it is for them to afford if their insurance doesn't cover it. And certainly I worry about the taxpayers that are footing the bill in terms of programs like Medicaid and Medicare and through the VA system. So this measure, that's a bipartisan measure that I introduced along with my colleague John McCain, requires transparency and ultimately accountability from these drug corporations. It requires them, if they are going to increase the price of one of their drugs by 10% or more, to report to the Department of Health and Human Services about the costs that might justify this, and it allows us to see whether these price increases have any justification at all.
And why 10%? What's magic about that number?
You know, the recent trend that we have seen is that companies are regularly hiking up prices by at least 10% or more. And these double-digit price increases are the ones that hit our families the hardest at the pharmacy counter. And the public deserves an explanation for double-digit price increases, which are particularly egregious.
And as you said, companies would be required to disclose details about spending on everything from research, development, manufacturing, marketing, advertising, if they were requesting an increase of over 10%. Has that information ever been tracked before?
You know, the companies have been incredibly opaque in their operations and rationale. And I think a lot of Americans think they're jacking up prices simply because they can, without any accountability. This would be new to require this transparency, and I think it's so important as we struggle to hold down health care costs.
And what kind of pushback are you getting or anticipating from industry? Because often when there are pushes for transparency or more disclosure from any kind of industry, they say, this is going to hurt us. This is actually going to cost consumers more because we are not going to be able to keep our industry secrets secret.
Right. So a couple of things in your question. One is, I do anticipate a lot of pushback from the drug corporations. You know, they have a lot of power in Washington, and I think have benefited from a rigged system where they call the shots. I don't work for those drug companies. I work for the people of Wisconsin, and it's time someone stood up for them. The number of inquiries and concerned calls and letters that I get from constituents who just don't know how they're going to be able to afford, whether it's an EpiPen for a child with allergies or some other life-saving medication, they're frightened, and their voices need to be heard. Now, as you mentioned in your question, there is confidential information that drug corporations are allowed to keep secret, trade secrets, for example. This legislation explicitly protects trade secrets and confidential commercial information from public posting. But they can't hide behind that with regard to all of these other pieces of information that this this reform requests. And it's time that American taxpayers and consumers and policymakers who, the taxpayers are footing the bill for these soaring drug prices, deserve to know how their money is being spent.
The United States is actually one of the few countries that allows direct advertising and marketing of drugs directly to consumers. That is clearly part of the expense that these drug companies are spending money on. Would you support efforts to eliminate that, to make it not possible for those drug companies to market?
Well, obviously, this bill goes in favor of disclosure of those expenditures so that the American consumer and the American taxpayer can know that as they're footing the bill, a significant percentage of it goes to this marketing. Our First Amendment is such that preventing them from advertising, I think, is a very huge challenge. And so this bill does not go in that direction, but simply says sunshine is the ultimate, in terms of transparency, that we need to shed light on this in order to get to the bottom of it. And hopefully, this information will allow some other reforms.
We're talking with Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin about her efforts to address rapidly rising drug prices. And Senator Baldwin, a lot of medications that are researched and developed never actually make it into patients' hands. Could this just create another hurdle or bad publicity for drug makers instead of holding insurance companies, for instance, responsible for picking up the cost of prescriptions?
You know, I think that we know well that development of new life-saving medications, life-extending medications, is a complex, time-consuming, and expensive process. And that's well understood as people develop these breakthroughs and assign an initial price. But let's take the example that's captured so much of the nation's attention in recent weeks, the EpiPen. That product has been around for a long, long time. The price was jacked up from $100 to $600 with no modification, as far as we know, in its formula, in its design, in its manufacture. We need explanations for things like that. And when we look at these drastic name brand price increases that have been going on in just this calendar year alone, it does not appear to be a consequence of research and development and innovation. However, when we pass this legislation, those sort of costs would be disclosed, and we can get a better grasp on the situation.
So companies would be allowed to raise prices. There's just more disclosure. So what happens if this bill is successful? What happens when a company does fill out the transparency and justification report for the Department of Health and Human Services? What happens then?
You know, I think that having this information available to policymakers, consumers, the general public, will help alter their ways. Right now, these drug corporations have a lot of power in Washington, D.C. They also have the power to simply raise the prices drastically in some cases with no accountability. This information is going to help policymakers better oversee the industry. And while you are correct, at this point, this is about transparency and accountability, I have a feeling that they'll think twice about jacking up prices if they have to disclose this information.
And, Senator, you're a member of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. What other measures have you proposed or is the committee working on to address this issue of rising drug prices?
Well, I can tell you that personally I have been long a strong champion of allowing the federal government, in particular our Medicare program, to bargain for better drug prices. You know, that happens within the VA system. It also happens, of course, with large private insurers that buy in bulk, in big quantities. Medicare certainly underwrites prescription drug costs for tens of millions of seniors and persons with disabilities. We ought to be exercising that muscle with the drug corporations in order to get more affordable prices for those who depend on Medicare, for example, as their primary insurance.
And as we wrap up, Senator, why introduce the bill now? We are near the end of a legislative session. There's a lot of attention and energy being put into an election coming up. What are your hopes in introducing it now?
Well, for a number of reasons. First of all, there was a time commitment in terms of crafting this legislation and making sure that it was going to be bipartisan from its onset, which obviously improves its chances. But we also have a moment where the American public is focused on this. We have had some really shocking cases of drug corporations abusing their power in recent months. Started with a company that I think jacked up the price several thousand percent in the case of Turing. And with the EpiPen, so many people know individuals with allergies that could be life-threatening. They understand, especially as school starts for parents, the need to make sure that not only is there an EpiPen at home, but also at a child care setting or school. So people are right now grappling with these recent drastic drug price hikes and are demanding answers. And I think that this nexus of the public attention being focused on this is a great time to introduce this bill and create some momentum.
Senator Baldwin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin. She joined us to talk about the bipartisan bill that she's co-sponsoring that would force drug makers to be more transparent about significant price hikes. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk about a new study showing American parents are less happy than parents in other nations.
Now, a new study from the Urban Institute in Washington found evidence that teens in the U.S. are trading sex for food. Researchers focused on 10 communities, both urban and rural, and found teens engaging in what's called transactional dating, where sexual favors are traded for a meal. The study results paint a picture of teenagers as particularly vulnerable when it comes to food scarcity and hunger.
Susan Popkin joins us now. She's a senior fellow and director of the Neighborhoods and Youth Development Initiative in the Metropolitan Housing and Communities Policy Center at the Urban Institute. Susan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, what did your study find about teenagers in the U.S. trading sex so that they could eat?
Well, that is the most sensational finding that we had, but really the whole study looked at the issues around teens and food insecurity. And I think even before getting into the kinds of risky behaviors that seems to make some teens seem to be vulnerable to, what we found that I found most shocking was the extent to which teens across the country are experiencing food insecurity, are familiar with it, and how normalized it has become in low-income communities, as you said, from rural areas to inner-city communities across the country.
And it sounded as though there was a set of language and behaviors around hunger that, as you said, was something that wasn't just happening in one place, but teens across the country were engaging in these kinds of behavior to keep food in their bellies and sometimes food in the bellies of their family.
Yeah, really what came through in our research is a sense of that a number of teens are getting pushed into sort of an expedited adulthood, where they are worrying along with their parents about the incomes, you know, the money coming into the house. They're worrying about their younger siblings. They go hungry so that their younger brothers and sisters can eat. And they put themselves at risk in lots of ways, including going hungry, which affects their school performance. Some of them drop out of school, and then some of them get pushed into this riskier behaviors. For the boys, it tended to be more from stealing small kinds of things like shoplifting. Even we heard about gangs and drug dealing, even in the rural communities. We heard some of the kids were familiar with kids who'd gotten involved with that. And then what you started with was we heard in every community we went to that kids were familiar with the phenomenon of girls getting pushed into transactional dating or being sexually exploited in order to find an older guy who could give them money, buy them food, help out their family. Now, we don't know how many kids this is affecting. It's certainly not all food insecure kids. But the fact that kids in every community we went to were familiar with these issues, knew about it, that nowhere we went to said, oh, that doesn't happen here, really was shocking to me.
Yeah, I know you've said
poverty research for 30 years.
Yeah, you said, I read that you've worked in low-income communities a long time, looked at the risk of sexual exploitation for women in these communities. But this seemed new. Why did that surprise you?
Well, it surprised me because we've heard about these kinds of sad things happening for kids who are out on the street, for homeless kids. But this is the first time we had heard about this happening for kids who are stably housed, living with their families. And in some cases, the families were living in public housing and getting housing subsidies. And it says to me there's just things have gone wrong. We know the economy has changed, and a lot of low-wage, low-income families are only able to access jobs that don't pay enough or jobs that don't offer enough hours or offer unstable hours. We also know that TANF, the welfare benefits, have been cut dramatically, so very few people are getting cash assistance anymore. And we know that rental prices have risen all across the country. Here in Wisconsin, there's been a big study of eviction in Milwaukee, and that just reflects what's happening all over the country as low-income families are struggling to pay rent and afford housing, and budgets are really stretched. And so I think what we were seeing is the fallout from that.
We're talking with Susan Popkin right now from the Urban Institute, and she's joining us to talk about a new study across the country, looked at 10 different communities and how teenagers deal with issues of food scarcity and hunger, including the new finding that teenagers in the United States are sometimes trading sex for food. So for Susan, for teenagers, especially girls, how does this sort of transactional dating, it sounds like a euphemism, but trading sex for food, how does that end up affecting these girls' lives and maybe their criminal records?
So I wanted to stress that these were focus groups, so we weren't asking kids about themselves. I've done other research looking more at these issues. They call it dating, so that's the word we use. They say they are dating older guys. And, they're teenagers, and they are very clear that they're not engaging in something that's more formalized kind of criminal behavior. And how it affects them is when one of the things that I think concerns us is that girls can get arrested, and that they get treated as status offenders instead of getting the kind of help and support that they need. And of course, that's happening to the boys who are getting arrested for the drug dealing or stealing or other things that they're engaged in as well. And I think there is a push in the Justice Department right now to take a more trauma-informed approach to kids who end up in the system that way, especially with all the research that's been coming out about how kids of color disproportionately end up getting charged with these kinds of status offenders or getting up with harsher punishments. So I hope that this will be something that people take into account when they're looking at kids who end up in trouble.
What do you mean by a trauma-informed approach?
Instead of arresting kids or putting them in juvenile hall, getting them into counseling and support, try to find out what's going on.
And what does your organization recommend as far as starting to turn some of these trends around?
The Urban Institute doesn't recommend anything, but we recommend evidence from our report. We think there are some things that are sort of quick fixes. One would be changing the SNAP program so that it takes into account that a 14-year-old needs more food than a 4-year-old. Right now, SNAP benefits, food stamps, are calculated just on the number of kids in the household. Another thing that's been tried and should be expanded is expanding summer benefits for families when kids don't get free lunch and free breakfast at school, making sure that the benefits go up in the summer to account for that. Those are sort of quick, easy fixes. I think that there's also, I believe my colleague Elaine Waxman, who wrote the other companion report, recommends things like teens even getting their own electronic benefits cards so they can get their own food. Then some of the things that we did and I found most hopeful, we're working with a group of kids in Portland, Oregon right now, having them design a teen-friendly food intervention, and they actually are running a harvest share program for their community. That's what they came up with, and you can see they feel very empowered. They feel like they're part of the solution and not part of the problem. And so more approaches that engage teens, that are easy for them to access. There are places around the country that are putting pantries in high schools. Anything we can do to reduce the stigma and make it easier for kids to access. We have to remember we are talking about teenagers, and the developmental stage they are at is where being different is just horrible, right? And they really don't want to be seen as the kid who is in need. So if there's a pantry in their school that's discreet or that any kid can access, that's going to feel a lot better to them than having to go to a pantry.
Susan, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Susan Popkin from the Urban Institute talking about teenagers and food scarcity.
And coming up, a new study shows that American parents can be less happy than their peers. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up tonight at 7, it's Snap Judgment. Tonight, sometimes the only word you hear is no. But what if you always said yes? On the next Snap Judgment, my beautiful, dark, twisted fantasy, riveting stories from people who pushed it to the limit. That's tonight at 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Polka always left writer Alex Bledsoe cold. That is, until he discovered the musical connection between his old home in Tennessee and his new home in Wisconsin.
Music is a huge part of my novels, but I'm no musician myself. If real music is, as Harlan Howard said, three chords and the truth, then I know two chords and some gossip. But I love music, and I try to constantly expose myself to new things. One of those new things is the official music of the Midwest, polka. Before moving to Wisconsin from Tennessee, what little I knew about polka was filtered through Weird Al Yankovic, whose early parody work featured the polka's best-known instrument, the accordion. Up until now, my experience with folk music has been tied to the Scotch-Irish songs that traveled over and settled, along with my paternal ancestors, in Appalachia. Polka, with its Eastern European roots, always felt a little harsh and off-putting. Luckily, I'm backdoor neighbors with James P. Leary, a folklorist who has just put out the monumental book Folk Songs of Another America, an encyclopedic collection of every sort of Midwestern folk, including the polka. Through him, I got to hear author Rick March, whose most recent book is Polka Heartland. On page 36, March writes, In 1863, to commemorate the defense of Charleston, South Carolina after a 60-day U.S. naval siege, a Columbia, South Carolina music publisher, B. Duncan & Company, issued Battery Wagner Polka Mazurka, with a cover lithograph of the cannons at Fort Wagner, a key emplacement in Charleston's defense. In a business circular dated July 27, 1863, Duncan wrote, "We have made arrangements to be constantly supplied through the blockade with the latest European music of merit, and will publish it as soon as received." It seems polkas were among the essentials smuggled into the South. And there it was, the connection between the place I grew up and my adopted state. They both come together in the story of polka smugglers. I'm learning to appreciate the music of the Midwest thanks to Jim and Rick. It's a bit like learning a foreign language, both literally, since many of the songs are in various dialects, and figuratively, since the atmosphere is so different. The folk songs of Appalachia are about longing and solitude, invoking isolated cabins and rolling mountains. The polka is about community and conjures up crowded basements and packed taverns. And yet, when you think about it, there's not that much distance, spiritually speaking, between the Appalachian classic, The Five Nights Drunk, and polkas, In Heaven There Is No Beer. So I think I'll get there.
Well, we got through it.
That's right. Another full take?
Another full take, probably.
All right.
Alex Bledsoe is the author of many books, including his most recent, Chapel of Ease. Our recording of the Battery Wagner Polka Mazurka is the song's first, arranged and performed by Sheila Shigley and Tom Blaine. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, having children is seen as a joyous event and a rite of passage for many adults. But while children themselves are thought to bring happiness and fulfillment to parents, American parents are markedly unhappy.
That's according to a new study looking at parental happiness compared to people without children in 22 developed countries. And that study found that not only were American parents unhappy, they were the least happy group studied.
Jennifer Glass joins us to talk about why parents in the United States are lagging behind their counterparts abroad. And she's a professor of sociology at the Population Research Center at the University of Texas at Austin, also co-author of that new report. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, what exactly is the parental happiness gap?
This is the gap in reported happiness between people who are parents currently having children living in the home and people who are not parents currently do not have children living in the home. So I want to make sure that everybody understands that this does not mean that Americans overall are really unhappy. Actually, Americans overall are pretty happy. At least we report high levels of happiness. But our gap between parents and non-parents is the largest in the industrialized world. So there are nations that, you know, people just generally don't report being as happy. We think that this reflects cultural standards that Americans are taught that they're supposed to be happy, and if they're not, it's their own fault. And in other cultures, it's kind of gauche to be trumpeting your happiness. So we really just focused on within country differences. How big was the gap in that country? And what we found was that the American reporters had the biggest happiness gap.
And why did you want to dive into this and find out exactly what was going on here?
There's a kind of cottage industry of sociologists and psychologists who study happiness in the United States, and they were coming out with a lot of information suggesting that parents were significantly less happy with their lives than non-parents. And this was picked up a lot by the media. There was even a book done by a reporter called All Joy and No Fun talking about parenting. And we were just wondering whether or not this could be a reflection of the way in which parenthood is organized in the United States with very, very little public support, whereas in many European nations and in other English-speaking nations like Australia and New Zealand, there's lots of public support for parents to make that transition to parenthood easier and to support a new families financially. So our working hunch was that maybe this unhappiness gap was really more about what it's like to be a parent in some societies and what it's like to be a parent in other societies. And not surprisingly, that's exactly what we found, that this happiness gap that exists in the United States is non-existent in the Nordic countries and in some Eastern European countries as well.
So it's not a story about how being a parent is overhyped and really you'll be happier if you don't have kids. It's more that if there are the structures in place, policies that support you as a parent, including financially and in other ways, that's what's causing the unhappiness, not the children themselves.
Right, exactly. So what we found is that parenthood as a phenomenon generally gives people lots and lots of pleasure, and parents, when you talk to them, will talk about the kind of undying love and devotion they feel for their children and how much they've enriched their lives. But when you get down to the nitty-gritty, the daily grind, the stresses of trying to be a parent in the United States, especially because most of our parents in the U.S. are expected to also work full-time, you find that our conditions of employment and our work schedules and other kinds of social policies regarding education, public schooling, and daycare are just very far behind what other countries are offering.
Can you compare a little bit for us? How does the United States look when you compare the policies that affect families with, say, someplace in Scandinavia that's pretty top of the scales when you look at policies, maybe Sweden?
We look terrible. We actually have what we call a comprehensive policy index that combined policies in a wide variety of areas, but most basically in terms of child care support, in terms of employment support, which would be paid parenting leave, but also paid sick and vacation leave. And then we also looked at work flexibility, how much flexibility you had to work from home or to change the hours or the days that you worked. And the U.S. gives workers the least entitlements to these, and our tax system gives the least preferential treatment. And our child care system is almost entirely privatized, and the government plays very little role in that. So, again, we had the biggest happiness gap, and we were dead last on the public policy index as well.
Did you take a look at, in particular, which policies caused or lack of those policies caused the most unhappiness?
Yes, and we were kind of surprised by what we found, because we thought that parenting leave was going to be really big. The fact that there's no paid maternity or paternity leave in the United States at the federal level, although a few states and jurisdictions have it. But we were very surprised to find out that the number one impact came from paid sick and vacation time. The countries that had combined days of paid sick and vacation time that were relatively high by government statute, have the smallest happiness gaps. There's a very strong correlation with that, as well as with the overall index. And the second most important factor was the average cost of child care for those under the age of 5 as a percentage of the median wage in that country. And what we found, again, is that child care costs are very high in the United States for the average worker, whereas in many, many countries, not only does the government strongly subsidize early childhood education like they do K-12 schooling, but they also provide high-quality preschool for all of their children. Whereas in the United States, again, it's kind of a patchwork. If you're lucky, you're in a city that has good options. If you're in a smaller community or in a rural area, you have really very, very few options for care outside the home.
And do you have a handle on whether this affects men or women more?
We were also surprised by this. Both men and women report the same sized happiness gap. So this is something that affects fathers as much as mothers. We did notice one slight deviation, but it was not, as we say in statistical language, it was not statistically significant. And that was that fathers were a bit more sensitive to the price variables, the cost of childcare, and mothers were a bit more sensitive to the amount of paid leave that you had. But again, these differences were relatively small, and I don't want to exaggerate them. In most cases, you could just say the story was very, very similar for moms and dads.
We're talking to Jennifer Glass right now about why American parents are unhappy compared to their parental peers abroad. She's a professor of sociology at the Population Research Center at the University of Texas at Austin. The findings from this research that it is the policies in place that do not support families and subsidize childcare, things like that, that make American parents unhappy compared to places where the policies are maybe more family friendly.
And we want to hear from you. Are you a parent feeling the pinch of
of no vacation time, high childcare costs, or maybe inflexible work environments. What would you like to see change in order to make your life as a parent easier? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page or email your thoughts to talk@wpr.org.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation about a new study that shows there's a massive gap in happiness between American parents compared not only to childless people in the United States, but to parents in countries like Sweden or France. And it turns out that gap is due to the policies that are in place, and the more supportive the policies are of the families, helping to pay for things, flexible work schedules, paid parental leave, the happier the parents are.
And we want to hear from you. Are you a parent who would like to see some of those more family-friendly policies implemented where you work? What would make you happier as a parent? And do you think this needs to be a nationwide effort to make, for instance, paid parental leave a reality? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Jennifer Glass stays with us. She's a professor of sociology at the Population Research Center at the University of Texas at Austin, and she co-authored this recent study we're talking about on the parental happiness gap. And Jennifer, one question we should ask right off the bat is, why should we care if a bunch of American parents are unhappy? I guess if you're unhappy and you don't have the supports because society isn't set up that way, maybe you don't have kids. So why should we care?
Well, you just put your finger on it. Maybe you won't have kids. Few people realize that one of the reasons why employers have tolerated massive illegal immigration in the United States is because there simply aren't enough babies being born in the United States to keep up our population. So, especially after following the recession, the United States is recording its lowest fertility rate in many, many, many years. Not since the Great Depression have we seen fertility rates this low. So honestly, we don't know of any societies that function well and economically prosper when they are predominantly filled with old people and have very few young people. And that's what the future of our country is going to look like if people decide en masse to just opt out of parenting.
And do you think that, given what you've seen so far, are we heading in that direction?
I think we are. This has already occurred in many European countries. In fact, it's a national obsession in countries like Spain and Italy and Greece right now. We're watching Russia, for example, depopulate, and this is going to have grave consequences for their economic security in the future. So most of the countries in Europe that have faced this issue square on are the ones that have developed these policies to encourage childbearing. And so, for example, you don't see this fertility problem in the Scandinavian countries. You don't see this fertility problem in France, but you do see it in Germany, and Germany is trying as fast as they possibly can to look more like the Scandinavian states in response to that. I also want to point out that these policies do not hurt the happiness of non-parents. So things like making sure everyone has adequate paid sick leave and vacation are things that people without dependents are just as happy about as parents are. They just matter more to parents because parents experience additional stress when they don't have adequate leave. So if you look at that and also look at the child care supports, we were amazed to find that countries that have better child care supports have happier non-parents. So these are people who are not directly using these child care supports. So we think these are what are called in economic terms positive externalities, things that make everybody happier because well-raised children are more productive workers, they're less likely to be delinquent, they're more likely to stay in school and learn more. So we think that everybody benefits when children's cognitive skills are developed, when we pay a lot of attention and invest in them when they're young.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Josh joining us from Elkhorn. Hi, Josh.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to say that I'm actually a single dad. I was the primary parent of my son for many years, and myself and his mother co-parent him. And I was just wondering, maybe if we could talk a little bit about the options that dads have with an absence of mothers. I've always had an interesting time kind of dealing with that whole process and that system myself.
Are you talking about policies, Josh, or something more social?
Even just social stuff, as far as kind of dealing with other parents or families. Also, I think a little bit along the lines of like access to health care, access to just stuff like that.
Josh, thank you. And what do you think, Jennifer? What advice or observations do you want to share with Josh?
I think that there are a lot of people in Josh's situation. We see more and more single dads, and of course the number of kids that are raised in solo parent households is at an all-time high right now. And one of the things we have to understand is that these policy supports that are nice for dual earner families are absolutely imperative for single parents. I mean, they literally don't have another partner that they can foist the pickup after school on, and they literally are the only one that can go to the parent-teacher conference or who can take the child to the doctor when they're sick. So being able to take paid leave in order to handle the medical emergencies of your children or even just routine appointments for yourself or your child's health are extremely important. And we see too often that parents get fired from their jobs because they have unexcused absences when they have to stay home with a sick child. And that just shouldn't happen, because when you fire somebody who's a parent, you're not just punishing them, you're also punishing the child.
Thanks a lot for that call, Josh. Appreciate that. And we're going to move to Fran in Caledonia. Hi, Fran.
Hi.
What did you want to share? Yeah, go ahead.
I have been both an employee. I'm in my 70s now, but I have been both an employee and an employer. I went to law school when my children were in their early teens and then practiced law. So I know the stress and the difficulty of trying to cope with handling your children's illnesses, getting to their school meetings, et cetera. But I also know the stress that it places on employers, particularly small employers. My law firm always worked around it because I was adamant that our employees, particularly our female employees, would be able to go to school conferences and stay home with sick kids. But it did cause disruption. So my thought is that if it were a national policy, something akin to unemployment insurance, then you would not have sort of arbitrary heavy burdens placed on employers when, let's say, there is a serious illness in the family or a parent is dying, that kind of thing.
Fran, thanks a lot for that. And Fran has seen what this looks like in action on both sides, it sounds like, and she thinks that it needs to be applied universally at the federal level. What do you think about that, Jennifer?
I absolutely agree with Fran. Your comments were brilliant. None of these other nations have called upon individual employers to provide these supports. They have all decided that this is part of literally Social Security. So their Social Security systems are cradle to grave. They're not just after 65 or 67. What they feel is that the general taxation revenues, sometimes they use different tax mechanisms, but the general taxation revenues should cover things that benefit the entire population. And they believe that keeping sick people home so that they don't spread diseases and making sure that parents have time to interact with schools and teachers is vital to the success of the economy. And if you look at the economic growth and the wealth of the countries that have made these investments, it's hard to argue against them because they are doing quite well relative to those nation states that have decided to avoid these kinds of family supports. So I completely agree. This is not something that small employers can handle on their own. This is a collective responsibility.
And Jennifer, do you see a political appetite and a social push to have the kind of policies that you're talking about?
Absolutely. What we're seeing is federal inaction and a lot of state and local action as a result. So if we could just get our Congress to actually talk about the issues facing the American people, maybe we could get some federal traction. There's clearly immense popular support for paid parenting leave. That was not among the things that was most impactful in our study because it really only affects people at the point of a birth. Unfortunately, after that kid turns one, you still have them for at least 17 more years, and they still get sick and they still need time from you. So we think that the paid sick and vacation leave are the policies that we should be pushing. Now, paid sick leave has a lot of traction. There are lots of cities and an increasing number of states that are providing paid sick leave. But I don't think it's fair to say, geez, the kind of support you get depends on where you live in this great country.
We leave it there. Jennifer, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on the show.
That was Jennifer Glass, professor of sociology of Population Research Center at the University of Texas at Austin, talking about a study showing that American parents are more unhappy than people, other parents abroad, and it comes down to the policies that support families. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time.